Hi everyone. How you going? Yeah, you all good? Yeah, we'll go home then. Okay, that was easy.
No, I'm miserable.
Oh, okay, okay, fine. Excellent. Welcome and nice to see many, many familiar faces and some new faces, and thanks for coming here. Thanks to the library for hosting the event and also for hosting me downstairs in the flat down here for these last few weeks. That's very kind. And so when I came back to Sydney this time, basically I didn't really have any plans and I didn't really organize anything, and so I literally rang Sue at the library a couple of days beforehand and said, oh, can I come and stay in the flat? And she said yes, so that's it. That's all my organizing. And then I jumped on a train and here I am. And so thanks to Milucci and Sam, I think, for putting this event together. Yep. So we're just doing this one event this time, and but we're thinking about perhaps what we might be doing next year. So I'm hoping to be around a little bit more in the next little while. So perhaps next year we might have some more regular events. So anyway, for this evening, we'll do some meditation. Does that sound like a good idea? Yeah?
Yeah,
meditation is good?
Yeah.
Yeah? And some Dhamma talk is good? Yeah? Okay, what kind of meditation would you like? Mindfulness? Metta? Anything else? Any other kinds of meditation? The Buddha taught 40 kinds of meditation. Shall we do one of the really far out ones? any other suggestions? We've got mindfulness, we've got metta, anything else? Anyone, any other suggestion anyone wants to do?
Body scan.
Body scan? Isn't that a kind of mindfulness meditation? Is it? Maybe. Okay.
I think it was just
me. Okay. Anyone else? No? No? Nibushi, you were going to say something.
No, it's just quite
a
good
thing. Okay, okay. A super practice. A super? Ah. Okay, very good. Okay, so a super practice is the contemplation of the body. But you contemplate the body to look at how the body really is quite ugly. I remember when I was in the first monastery I was at in Chiang Mai, this monk said, oh yes, the body is ugly. I'm like, speak for yourself, mate. So it can be quite a challenging practice. Okay, so now we have these three. I'm going to get you to vote for it because we live in a democracy. Mindfulness practice. How many people want to do mindfulness? Just straight mindfulness. I mean, mindfulness is always there, right? So, but anyway, okay, so that's a few. Metta? A bit more popular. And what about asubha? Contemplation.
Oh!
It's again for asubha? No, I think metta wins, unfortunately. You're going to have to do some more lobbying beforehand if you want to get the asubha vote. Okay, so we'll do some metta meditation. So what I might do is just talk about meditation for a few minutes beforehand, just give a bit of background, and then we can do some guided meditation. Many people have been to my talks before and know that I teach a lot of metta meditation. And why do we practice metta? Why do we practice love and kindness? Well, because it's nice, I guess. Really. Because it's pleasant and it's fun and it's an enjoyable form of meditation. And so one of the things that the Buddha said was that the mind which is the mind which is happy becomes peaceful. The mind which is peaceful will see things as they really are, and the mind which is to see things as they really are will become free. So we practice loving kindness meditation to develop our emotions, to become a kinder person, to treat people better, to be more sensitive to people, all of those reasons, which we can observe here and now. but it also leads to a deepening of our spiritual path, and to a deepening of our spiritual path, which ultimately results in freedom. And so through that practice of loving kindness, the practice of love, we experience it as something which is very, very gentle and very happy and very blissful in the here and now. Seeing Mariana here, I'm reminded of the retreat we did in Italy. Yes, it was very nice. We did a mental retreat there. And there I asked the old Christian monk about how they translate the word love in Christianity. Because in ancient Greek or ancient Latin or something, they have two words for love. One is like a spiritual love, like metta, and the other one is a romantic love. And he said, well, they just use the same word in English for both of them. And I thought that was interesting, because in Pali you have the same thing. You have words for like family love and relationship love and sexual love and so on. And metta, which is always a spiritual love. And usually in Buddhism most people translate metta as loving kindness. And I still do that myself. It's not a bad translation. But I think it's an interesting choice why we've chosen a non-word for translating it. Loving kindness is actually an actual word in English. And I think something about it is that there's some way like when we use that word, there's somewhat of an emotional distancing. It's not a word that really sort of connects or speaks to the heart like the word love does. And when we use the word love, it's very potent, it's very powerful, and it's quite vulnerable. I feel it myself when I'm talking about it. It's easier to talk about loving kindness, it's a bit more distancing. Whereas when we talk about love, it's a bit more, whoa. Right? And so, but I think that vulnerability, yeah, and that openness really is part of what metta is all about, right, and part of what the practice of love is all about. And so the idea in Buddhism is not that there's any great difference or fundamental distinction between the love that we have for ourselves, love we have for a family, sexual love, romantic love, and so on. These things are not completely different from the kind of love that we develop in metta meditation. Okay? But rather, that the love that we develop in metta meditation evolves, is an evolved form of the love that we already feel and the love that we know. So that's why in Buddhism we always use the word bhavana. And so bhavana means to develop something, to grow something, to make it evolve, to make it become better. So the metaphor that the Buddha used for this was the love that a mother has for her child. And in the love that a mother has for her child, we see something of the purity and the strength and the innocence of that. And also that is not just an emotion. Well, not when I say not just an emotion, I mean it's not just a feeling or experience, because actually in the Metta Sutra itself, it says that just as a mother would give her life for her own child, right? That means that it's bound up with action. It's bound up with what you do. Right? So the love that a mother has for a child, she doesn't just say, you know, I love you, and, you know, go about her day and say, yes, I really kind of, you know, it means something, you know. It changes who she is and everything about her and her life and what she does. It changes how you live. It changes what kind of person you are. It changes what kinds of choices that you make. And so when we develop metta through meditation, what we are doing is we're taking that kernel of love that we might feel for anyone, for any sentient thing, and we are developing it and we're nurturing it and we're making it grow. And through doing that, we are, in a way, we are paying attention to, or we are working from that which is best in ourselves. This, I think, is something that's very important. One of the, I mentioned before, the word bhavana, or development. One of the words for a perfected person in Buddhism, an arahant, is bhavitata, meaning someone whose self is developed. And so what that means is that those things inside yourself, which are already there, are the things which we're developing in meditation. You already have love. You already have kindness. You already have mindfulness. You already have peace. You already have generosity. Right? It's just mixed in with a lot of other rubbish. Right? Yeah. So we shouldn't think of these things as being something which is alien to us, which is outside. We're not calling on some God to bless us with something. We're not calling on some external force. We're not trying to create something that isn't there. It's there. It's inherent in who we are, in what it means to be conscious, to have a mind. So in the process of meditation, what we learn to do is to focus on, to identify those best parts of who we are, to keep our awareness with those things, to hold them and to foster them. And little bit by little bit, to see those things grow and develop. And it really is something that's amazing. When you see the experience of metta, the experience of peace in meditation, you realize that that thing is inside you all along. It's incredible. It's so powerful. And for me, this is one of those, you know, something that I always remember as one of the key kind of moments or transformations in my own spiritual practice. One time I was on a retreat in Thailand, in a place called Dalam in the forest. And in the evening I would chant the Metta Sutta. And this was even before I started doing Metta meditation or anything like that. And up until that point, I've had you know, a lot of different experiences and so on in my meditation, but up to that point, a lot of my meditation was really struggling. It's really dry. It's really, yes, you do it because you know it's good for you. And occasionally you can see, oh yes, something is happening, or you know, you can see some kind of difference. But a lot of it is like, doesn't really seem to be a lot going on there. You know, I'm watching my breath, and yeah, sure, it goes in and out, and I'm being mindful of this and that, and yeah, okay, I can be mindful of it, but that's about it, you know? And so what happened is during the reciting of the sutta, and just really sort of taking the meaning of the words in and chanting them, and I could feel this sense of joy, and the sense of what I later recognized was piti, or rapture. It's one of the factors of meditation in Buddhism. And rapture is a sense of uplifting joy, overflowing joy. And when you're developing the meditation, especially the meditation on love, that's what comes up, or what can come. It's like a flood. And when that first happened, I was just shocked. Right? It's not that I had thought that I couldn't do that, okay? It's that it had never occurred to me to think like that. It never occurred to me to imagine that I was the kind of person that could actually just have that kind of experience. And I'd never known what these words were, what they really meant. What does love mean? What does joy mean? I thought I knew what they were, I could tell you what they were, but I never experienced them. And so these moments that you have in your practice and in your meditation development, they'll stay with you forever. I can still remember that very clearly. I can remember the hut that I was in, I can remember what it looked like, where I was sitting on the ground, exactly what was going on. It's such a powerful moment because you realize that that love that they talk about is something that exists inside you. Now, in spiritual practice, one of the problems that we have in spiritual practice is the problem that, I don't know how to put this, often we have a lot of expectations and we like to sort of project a lot of things. So if we're meditators, or if we think that we're Buddhists, or even if we just think we're someone interested in spiritual things or whatever, then we kind of feel like we have to be nice, right? We have to be kind all the time. And so we have to sort of project and repress if you have any feelings of anger and all those kinds of things. And one of the interesting things about when you start doing metta meditation is that it's quite common for meditators to then feel more anger than they had before. Right? John, what are you doing? I couldn't do this. Oh, dear. All right. Sorry, everyone. What was it, bang that anger? Oh, yes, right. And it's something that I've heard from quite a lot of people, is that you think that you're not a very angry person, right? When you start doing metta meditation, you start getting really annoyed with people. I'm really upset with them. Yeah? And you think, what's going on? Am I doing something wrong? So what's happening, I think, when that goes on, is that your defenses, your denials are starting to dissolve. Right? So even before you were denying, even to yourself, that you're actually getting angry. You're learning to hide it, to pretend it's not there. And so when you're doing that metta meditation, sometimes it can come up very, very fiercely. Okay? You're sitting there, metta, oh, everything's very nice, very kind. And suddenly you think of that person and your mind goes in the wrong direction and this flame of anger comes up. My goodness. Okay? So this is a sign that it's working. Right? It's a sign that you're doing actual genuine inner work in your meditation. Right? You're not just hiding stuff. Right? Meditation is not about repressing things, it's not about hiding things away. It's about understanding, it's about awareness. So, in the meditation, the beginning of the meditation, we sit down, we establish our mindfulness, we bring awareness inside your body, and we learn to notice the feelings of metta and feelings of love that are already there. So this is one of the big moments your meditation, right? And you're sitting there meditating and you've never experienced anything like this, you don't know what I'm talking about, you're thinking, he's just talking about this because he's a monk and it's different for them, or blah 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 and so on, but not me, right? But there will come a time when you realize, oh yes, it is me. I too can feel that. And oh, that's exactly what they were talking about. That's what that metta is. And you see that spark inside yourself. Okay? Now, that's one of the things which is really difficult to teach, right? You can't really teach it, you can't transfer it, you'll either experience it or you won't experience it. Some meditators don't have that experience. Or maybe they don't have it for a long time or whatever. Others will just sit down and there it is. Right? It's very, very individual, and curiously enough, it doesn't seem to be closely related to how loving and kind a person is in their ordinary life, which is kind of weird, isn't it, right? I mean, I've known people people who are like very, very loving mothers, always looking out for people, always caring for people and so on, and yet when they do metta meditation, they say there's nothing there. Well, you can see them, you know that they're very loving people, right? And so what that can be sometimes is that their love is always directed outwards and always caring for others, but they're still not able to love themselves. On the other hand, maybe you've got somebody who's like really snappy and angry and short-tempered, and when they do metta meditation, they feel a lot of metta. Yeah? Why? Because the anger is finally gone, and they feel so happy when that anger is gone, yeah? Even just a moment. So don't have any expectations on this, is what I'm saying. Don't think, oh, it works for me, it doesn't work for me, you know, this is good, I've got this, or I haven't got that. Don't worry about any of those things. Don't worry about what other people are doing. One thing that you find in metta meditation, it's quite common for people to, at a certain point, to get a big smile on their face. Yeah? So if someone's sitting there grinning away, don't think to yourself either, A, what an idiot, or B, I wish I could feel some of that happiness, okay? Don't worry about it. Yeah? We all are going to experience something different. And it will take some time, but if you're willing to be patient, willing to spend the time with it, then the metta, the practice of love, can be a wonderful friend for you and a companion for you in your whole life. And if you know that that love is inside you, you can always come back to it. Wherever you are, you can just sit down there for a few minutes and you can come back and you can experience that. And so you always have a place of happiness and joy, which you realize, oh, this is my real home. It's very good for me, because I don't have a home. I just wander around the place. But I know that if I sit down and I meditate, that I can find some peace and joy inside myself. So I'm not too worried about all the external things. Okay, so we'll do some meditation. We'll do, does half an hour sound good for meditation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about half an hour. And during this meditation, we will begin by doing loving kindness for yourself. Okay, so loving kindness for oneself. And secondly, we'll do metta for a loved person. All right? And so this is a particular method that I'm teaching, and for those of you who are not familiar with it, then you should know that there are many different methods for doing meditation. Don't worry about it too much. All methods are good. Not one's right and one's wrong. But if you're trying a particular method, then just do that method at that time and give it your best shot. Because you never really learn about how that method works unless you really try it. It doesn't mean other methods are better than other methods or whatever. It just means that you try your best to do that one and at least give it a good try. But this is the method I'm teaching, I think, is a good one. Otherwise, I wouldn't teach it. I wouldn't practice it. And before we start, so we'll do metta for a loved person. And before we start, I want you to choose one loved person that you can develop metta for during the meditation. Right? So that should be somebody who you feel a simple and uncomplicated love for. Okay? Often not somebody who you're too close to. Because people that we're very close to often we have like complicated emotions about. So someone often maybe who's a little bit distant, like maybe even a co-worker or a friend of the Buddhist society, or maybe like a cousin or grandchild or something like that. But anyway, I'll leave that up to you. But just somebody who you can feel a simple and uncomplicated love for. Alright, and we'll do some meditation for about half an hour. Can we dim the lights that are doable thing. and sit quietly. Just take a moment to settle back inside your body. If you need to adjust your posture, make sure you're sitting comfortably. And take a few minutes to let the mind settle back into the body. Moving the mind through different parts of the body. Just feeling what it's like. You can feel the different movements of energy, tensions, pressures. Actually, the body is very giving us a lot of information all the time. Just what kind of mood that you're in. Feel it inside your belly, inside your chest. What is it that you've brought in from the day? Anxiety or despair? Hope? Joy? Maybe nothing in particular. It's okay. Just be aware of it. It's just a feeling. It'll come and go. And leaving the mind resting in your heart, say to yourself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, May I be happy. Keeping the words going on and on. Making a solid and firm foundation for the mind. Being sure to articulate the words clearly and distinctly to yourself. Bringing a sense of care to every aspect of the meditation. You're wishing for yourself. See if you can see that, not just the words, but see if you can see the reality of it, the experience of it. Like a glow or a little flame inside your chest. Life, happiness, and joy. It spreads out through your whole body. met our core love person. And keeping your mind just where it is, settled in your body, and bringing in the name of that love person. May that love one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Again, keeping the words strong and steady. They're there to support your mind. spreading the same metta out to all beings in the world. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings. Bringing the mind back inside the body. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. And then letting the words metta go. Letting that feeling of love fade away. Just watching as the mind comes back to a neutral space. Before we finish, take a minute to reflect back over the meditation that we've done. Asking yourself, what was that all about? What happened during the meditation? How did I respond to the different stages of the meditation? Was there any feeling there at all? Was there any of that sense of joy or love? If there was, did that grow and change? What happened to that during the meditation? But finally, ask yourself, how is your mind now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And if you get into the habit of reviewing your meditation like this, just for a few minutes at the end of each sit, then gradually you'll learn to understand why meditation goes the way it does. Why sometimes the mind becomes peaceful, and why sometimes it doesn't. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings find peace and awakening. Now it's time for a Dhamma talk. Does anyone have any ideas what I should talk about? Something to do with Buddhism?
What is there with a t-shirt in the world?
Or lack thereof.
It's Tokyo, what do you like?
So I'd usually work around to that somehow.
Is there God in Buddhism?
No. That's easy.
Staying present. How about Buddhist perspectives on the shadow? So you know how you were speaking before about like anger coming up in metta meditation.
Right.
You know, those taboos when we put on the smiley face in the Buddhist circles. But, you know, Jung would talk about the shadow, and I'm wondering if there's something that would be the equivalent to that, like Buddha being visited by Mara or something, you know, like our visits by Mara.
Interesting. Okay. Any other ideas, folks?
And true.
What's this?
So there's a lot of discourse going on in the world at the moment, you know, in terms of you know, how do you know something is true? There's variations. You've got a president in the United States talks about fake news. You've got, you know, people being accused of things, sometimes true, sometimes not. So there's a lot of energy being put into people, you know, trying to discern what is true.
Okay.
And how is that kind of world be true to relate to Dharma?
Okay. Good. Balancing loss of wisdom. Okay. So that's like a whole course of talks for next year. It's very efficient. We've laid out the whole curriculum. Okay, well, I will take all those suggestions on board, and I will see whether I can address any of those concerns during the talk. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Asaro tate sumatasambhuara yasotamantra punchakisandhara. So, when we, as was mentioned earlier, I've spent the last couple of years translating Buddhist scriptures, translating texts from the Pali, and it's a very rewarding process because I get to spend all day listening to the Buddha and hearing what the Buddha had to say about things. So that's pretty neat. And one of the things that I always noticed about Buddhist scriptures is that almost always, when you read something, then it has some kind of ring of truth, or ring of reality. Like it's actually saying something which is meaningful, but also something which you, it's not just true in a trivial sense, but something which you recognize as being virtuous, as being good. There are a few occasions where you see something and you think, oh, that's not right. Can that be right? Now, I remember one of those things is the first line in the Mangala Sutta, which when I first saw it, I thought, oh, that's not very nice. The first line in the Mangala Sutta, asevana cha balana, not to associate with fools. See, I mean, if I took that seriously, I just wouldn't be here. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Joke, okay. Just a joke, everyone. Right? Not to associate with fools, right? Sounds a bit mean, doesn't it? Right? We're just going to abandon those poor fools, suckers, deal with it, you know? We're going to save ourselves. And just let those poor fools, because we don't care about them. Is that right? Is that what that means?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it means?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Thanks. So you're cool with that?
Well, that has a lot to do with Western psychology, particularly among those who are narcissists and things like that, who regard other people who they think are inferior, and will denigrate them.
Right. Yeah.
It's common. It's a don't suffer fools lightly.
Right.
And they say that in a denigrating, castigating tone. They don't like these people, and they don't think they're worthwhile for anything.
Well, yes, in the context of someone who's a narcissist, then a fool essentially is somebody who disagrees with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you translate the word balana to fool? Can it be the exact meaning of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds pretty good.
Balana means that.
In the both, yeah.
Various definitions in books from the people who understand the reality and who don't understand the reality. There's a difference between those two kinds of people, I think.
Sure.
Instead of saying Balana is whole, can it be defined in different ways?
Well, you can always define something differently if you want to, but I don't think it's too bad as the translation goes. Mm-hmm. Actually, the literal meaning it comes from is the meaning of a baby or a child. So anyway, let me keep going. So, not to associate with fools. Now, you also have this principle of found in the Dhammapada, where it says that a fool who knows that they're a fool is wise at least to that extent. Yeah, so that's actually a very profound insight, and one which is shared by the Buddha, also found in Greek philosophy as well. Yeah? So a fool who knows that they're a fool is wise at least to that extent. Okay, so this also is interesting. And some of you may have heard in psychology they talk about the Dunning-Kruger effect. Yeah? You know about that?
No.
Dunning-Kruger effect is an effect that where they say that that unintelligent people tend to think of everybody else as being less intelligent than they really are. Right? Whereas intelligent people tend to overestimate the intelligence of other people. Yeah? And it's one of those kind of sort of thing. So basically, if you're a fool, you tend to think everybody else is a fool. And if you're wise, then you tend to overestimate other people. You tend to see more wisdom than is really there. Yeah? It's true to a certain extent. Not an absolute rule, of course, but just a tendency. But in that principle that says that a fool who knows they're a fool is wise to at least that extent, you can see they're actually going against that tendency. Right? Oh, I know that I'm being foolish. Right? That's where the beginning of self-awareness starts. And the whole round of suffering begins with ignorance. Yeah? Dependent origination, the first factor is avidya, ignorance. So we begin with ignorance. So we're all fools. Right? So we're not associated with fools, we never associate with anyone. Okay. So
is
that makes quite.
Is a fool in as far as just with ignorance?
If you could just let me. Well, I've got to ask questions more at the end. Yeah. Thank you. So we're all fools because we all start from ignorance, but some of us realize that we're fools, and this is the beginning of wisdom. So why is it that the Buddha said not to associate with fools? One of the things that I've come to sort of reassess this teaching, like I said, when I first saw this teaching, I thought I didn't really like it. But I've come to reassess it over time, mainly because of this curious little thing, which I don't know if you've heard of, but this curious little thing called the internet. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
It's like this computer thing that people can communicate and stuff. And I don't know if you noticed, but there's a lot of fools on the internet. Right? weird that you walk, when you walk down the street, everyone seems perfectly nice. You know, and you go shopping or you sit at a restaurant and life is sharp, and then you look on the internet and you think, oh my god, what kind of species is this? It's a huge difference, isn't it? It's weird. And so one of the things that I've learned to do over time, you know, is just ignore the faults. There's no point trying to persuade people, trying to reason with people and all that kind of thing. This is when I began to realize actually what that meaning of a Seva Nachabala is. You know? It doesn't mean someone necessarily is unintelligent or who doesn't know things or whatever, but somebody who hasn't actually realized the beginnings of their own foolishness. Somebody who hasn't actually begun that process of self-awareness to be able to reflect and to see and to be able to think, oh, actually, I should learn. I should grow. And so this is where that notion of truth is starts to shift. I think that normally what tends to happen, like normally what tends to happen in our minds is that whatever we think that that's true. Right? That's a kind of default assumption, right? You know, in the morning you think, oh, today's Wednesday, so you think that's probably true, right? Until you, you know, see something that makes you question that. Right? And so we tend to go through our life thinking that our thoughts are true. Yeah? And this was actually one of the things that I noticed first when I came out of my first retreat in Chiang Mai. So I did 1 month long retreat, very, very intensive retreat. And I came out, everything had changed. And I remember staying in the guest house in Chiang Mai, sitting at the table at the guest house, and everyone's chatting and so on, the usual travelers talk, going here, doing this and things like that. And I realized that everyone at the table is just assuming that what they're thinking is true. No one's actually reflecting on their thoughts. Why do they think like this? Where is that coming from? What is it that I want? And I found it so strange. I felt this sense, honestly, got completely alienated from everyone. And I got better over time. You get used to these things, right? But when you first experience it, and you see it, that's so weird that everyone walks through their whole life just assuming that their thoughts are correct. And of course, if you do that to like a pathological degree, then of course that's what we call a narcissist or something, right? Basically, that truth is your ego, right? That's all the truth is. There isn't any external truth by which you can judge or correct or learn anything, right? Whatever you think is the reality, and if facts don't agree with your reality, there's something wrong with the facts. Yeah? And that's that deep kind of narcissism. Yeah? So, in our spiritual life, in our meditation, we learn to reflect, we learn to look inside our own minds, and we learn to see that our thoughts actually come from conditions. Our thoughts, our emotions, our ideas, all of these things, they come from conditions. Often what tends to happen is that we repeat same kinds of thoughts that we've had before, so churning them over, telling ourselves stories, interpreting things, justifying our actions, right? Telling ourselves all the reasons why that other person's wrong and we're right, all of those kinds of things. And all of that is kind of building up our sense of ego, our sense of self. Right? So it's there to create a sense of who we are and to define that. And when we begin to meditate, we begin to unfurl that. Right? We begin to unwrap that. And we begin to say, oh, actually, what our self is not any of those things. And what our self is what we take ourselves to be is really often very kind of small and mean and not very nice. So why is it that we feel the need to defend ourselves, to suspend the sense of who we are. And we're like a little kind of shellfish or something like that. You know, inside ourselves we feel that we're so soft, so tender, so sensitive. And so we put this big shell around us. And that's all of our ideas, all of our thoughts, all of our justifications, all of those things. It's like a rocky shell around us to stop the world from hurting us. In our meditation, we just start to open that up a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. And we start to see what that reality is, what the world around us is like. And the beautiful thing about that is that we discover very often that we didn't have to be so afraid. I mean, sure, okay, in many times the world really is pretty awful and does do terrible things for us, and it's understandable why people have these shells. But often we outlive them. We outlive their usefulness. We don't need them, and yet we still carry them around. And when you open up and you allow that contact between yourself, between the flesh of who you are and the world outside, it's okay. And you start to perceive the reality of that world rather than projecting your fears and your hopes onto it. Yeah. So when the Buddha talked about truth, he talked about the noble truth. Yeah. Noble truth. Arya Satya. And the explanation of that is always said to be that it's noble truth because the truths, the Four Noble Truths themselves, are beautiful and they are themselves noble. But even more so, they're considered to be noble truths because they are ennobling. Because when you realize that, it ennobles yourself, your mind, your heart. So a lot of the process of meditation is like that, right? Like little shellfish, when we think about that shellfish, and when we're relaxing our mind, we're opening our mind, we're being present, we're being aware, we're gradually allowing that shell to open. And so in the meditation, we're creating a space where it's okay to do that, right? We're creating a space within which we are safe, within which we are comfortable, within which it's all right to open up. And so the more we feel that sense of relaxation, the feeling of pleasure, the feeling of ease in meditation, the more that our mind opens up, and the more that we can expose ourselves to the reality of the world. And of course the reality of the world that the Buddha talked about, dukkha, suffering. So that's the trick, okay? So the path of meditation is the path of happiness, it's all very peaceful, it's all very lovely and so on, and then at the end of it, it's like wham, nah, it's all suffering. Even that pleasant stuff that you thought was so nice, that's all suffering too. You know, just deal with it. Right? So we lure you in, you know, Buddhism is sort of like a fish trap, it's sort of like, oh, it's so peaceful, it's so nice. It's all marketing, and then you sit and meditate and you know, itchiness and restlessness and stuff. Where's that piece? Anyway, so dukkha, yeah, suffering. Dukkha samudaya, the origin of suffering. Dukkha nirodha, the ending of suffering. Dukkha nirodha, gamani and pratipada, the path or the practice that leads to the end of suffering. Four noble truths. So they're noble truths because they are themselves noble, but they're also noble truths because they ennoble the practitioner who realizes them. Yeah? So just think about what that means, to realize that the reality of suffering. Suffering is true. So normally, of course, we kind of know that there's suffering and stuff around in the world, but we like to sort of hide away from. We don't like to see it too much. A little bit, all right, but we don't want to see it too much. and it gets very, it's very depressing, isn't it? Right? We know how much suffering there is in the world, how much injustice there is in the world. Right? And all the kind of the terrible things that humans do to other humans, or that we do to the environment, and all of these kinds of things. And it's so terrible, and we know that there's so much suffering, we know that there's so much suffering that is completely unnecessary. I mean, sure, there's suffering that's necessary. We're all going to get old and die, and that's a necessary form of suffering. But then there's a lot of suffering that's just because people are greedy. It's just because people don't give a shit. Right? And it's just because we elect people. Sorry, am I allowed to say that? What's naughtier, saying give a shit or not actually giving a shit? Sorry, I thought I didn't offend anyone. So, and so we put these people in positions of power, the wealthy and the powerful and so on, and they're able to make decisions about things. And, you know, we sometimes put the worst of humanity in these kinds of positions of power, and they mess up so many things. Sorry, when I say that, I can't help thinking I'm going to Singapore in a few weeks' time, and I'm going to be there on
June 12th.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. So that's going to be another thing messed up. Anyway, so, right, so the Four Noble Truths. So, often what we find, the traditional cliche about Buddhism is that Buddhism sort of focuses on suffering, and it's all about suffering and negativity and things like that. But when I hear this critique, I'm like, have you ever met a Buddhist? I don't know. I mean, here we have a shrine. We have a picture of a peaceful man sitting up there smiling on the shrine. I don't want to sort of name names, but if you look at certain other religions, I don't know, they have other things on their shrines that aren't quite so peaceful sometimes. I don't know. But anyway, leaving that aside. And we're just more upset and depressed and so on than most people, I don't think, are we?
Mm-hmm. On par.
On par, you reckon? No better or worse? I don't know. I think most Buddhists are kind of okay. And when the Buddha was teaching, he didn't just sort of dump suffering on people's heads and say, just deal with it, right? He would teach in a gradual way. He would build up to it. Right? Like I'm saying, you sort of do a bit of a con job, really. Just sort of make people feel happy beforehand. You know, it's like we did today. We did some nice metta meditation, we're talking about love, and I crack a few jokes, and make you feel relaxed and stuff. Then I sort of put the stuff in. But then we're ready to understand it. Right? We're ready to appreciate it. Right? So we can start to let those truths go in. And when we have that peace in mind, we can gradually let those shells open, we can let those walls down, we can let that truth and that reality in. We can realize, okay, some of those delusions that we had about ourselves, and we thought we were so smart, but actually we weren't so smart, we thought we were kind, but actually we were being selfish and all of those things. Sometimes it's hard to hear, it's hard to accept. And you can realize that, and gradually let the mind become a little bit more and more open. And the more open the mind becomes, the more reality experience, and the more honest and more honesty and more integrity that you develop inside yourself. So this is the Four Noble Truths, right? The suffering that is part of all of our experience, the cause of suffering, which of course is craving and attachment. Right? Craving and attachment. We want pleasure. We want to avoid pain. But it's not just about pleasure and pain. Right? Craving attachment is also about being. Right? Bhavatana. We want to exist. Right? Specifically, we want to be reborn. Right? Or we bhavatana, we want to be not reborn. Right? So our minds are in a kind of, there's always kind of a tension in our minds that on the one hand we want this to keep on going, right? We want more, right? And we never satisfy it. But at the same time, we want to get rid of it. because we know that it's suffering. We're always in this kind of tension between these two things. It's why so much of human behavior is very, very self-destructive. You know, we go out drinking and all of this kind of stuff. This is this kind of internalized self-destructive behavior. And so we're constantly being driven by these kinds of things, and it's creating more suffering. So when we meditate, our mind becomes open, we can realize the reality that suffering is something that we're generating from inside ourselves, so our attachment and desires. And if we have enough mindfulness, enough clarity, enough guts, we can let go. Let the shell open completely. And when we let that open completely, it's the ending of suffering, ending of all attachments. And the last one of the noble truths that we've talked about is the noble truth of the path. And of course the Buddha mostly focused on speaking about the path to the ending of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. And in fact, I analyzed the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, and of the suttas, of all suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, about 80% of them dealt with the practice. They dealt with the path leading to the ending of suffering. So Buddha, like the third noble truth in Nibbana, the ending of suffering, the Buddha actually spoke about that fairly rarely. He would speak about it occasionally in past, or no, not infrequently, but usually just very briefly. But the path, he spoke about a lot, in a lot of detail, a lot of depth, and a lot of different aspects of things. Yeah? Ethical conduct, and generosity, restraint, contentment, all of these things are aspects of that path. And so one of the important things about that path is that it's not just what we do when we're sitting in a temple, it's not just what we do when we're doing meditation, right? It's not just Buddhist things. And it's got nothing to do with Buddhism, really. So the path is how we choose to live our lives. How we earn a living, right? Is the path. Right? When you go to work every day, you don't think, oh, I can't practice because I have to go to work. Going to work is your right livelihood. It's one of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? And if while you're working, that you're thinking, oh, I should be meditating, I can guarantee you, while you're meditating, you'll be thinking about your work. Right? So the way to practice with these things is when you're working, you work. Yeah? You work 100%. It's one of the things I learned from my teacher, from Ajahn Brahm. You know? One time the monks were doing some brickwork on one of the huts, because the monks always do hard physical labor, and they were laying the bricks, and Ajahn Brahm was out there laying bricks. And all of the monks, there's like two or three monks there, and they're all talking about arupa attainments, formless attainments, these very, very high meditation attainments, right? Which of course, none of them had anything even close to that, but Ajahn Brahm was the only one who actually had really deep meditation, and he was just being quiet and laying bricks. Right? And that's one of the things I really learned from him, that he would, whatever he was doing, he would do it 100%. Yeah? If he's with someone, he's with them 100%. If he's laying bricks 100%. If he's talking on Dharma, he's talking on Dharma 100%. And if he goes on retreat, he does that 100%. So this is the path of practice, right? The Noble Eightfold Path. So it's just a few words for this evening that's about all I have to say at the moment, but a few words for this evening on the topic of the truth and the noble truths, and about that idea of not associating with fools and what that really means. And so I offer this view of reflection this evening, and I hope that's been of some value, or at least of some amusement from time to time. And if anyone has any questions or comments, please. Okay.
What you were saying before about it's very difficult for us to see our own delusion, and it seems that you need a certain amount of self-doubt to be able to do that, to be able to, it seems that you need to have a certain amount of questioning of your perceptions and beliefs.
Sure. Yeah.
But at the same time, doubt is an obstacle on the path. So, but how do you know whether to doubt or have faith in your perceptions or beliefs or attitudes or whatever?
I think there is a difference though between doubt, which is crippling, and a genuine sense of inquiry. I don't know that it's always, you know, it's not always clear cut, and it's not always possible to really know the difference between them. But I think we can recognise that there is that difference. And so really we just kind of do the best that we can. And a lot of it just comes from experience and from reflecting on that experience. Yeah. And often, yes, we do make mistakes like that, right? So you may be doing something and then inside yourself there's a little niggling doubt and you ignore it and you do it and then you realise, oh, actually that was a mistake. Yeah. So that happens. You just learn from it, that's all. But the real difference, if you ask what's the difference between doubt and genuine inquiry, the real difference is clarity of mind. So if you have clarity of mind, then that wisdom will come from there, and then you'll know that difference.
But how do you know when you have clarity of mind?
Experience, yeah.
So how do you know that you were seeing something or perceiving something that you should have faith in?
Again, I would say by reflecting on cause and effect, reflecting on the process of things. You know, I mean, you just use common sense, listen to the best advice you can get the best information you can get. You can go away, you can sit in meditation. Don't think about it in meditation, but the choice, the decision about what to do will very often come to you in meditation, and you'll just know. Yeah? And then you just do it, and then you observe the outcomes. Did it actually work the way that I thought? And then you learn from that. Yeah.
So it seems like in some cases that would work, and maybe others that wouldn't work, but would you say that meanwhile we should try and hold our beliefs lightly, or?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, holding beliefs lightly is good. Yeah.
But is there a feeling that goes with having that kind of?
A feeling of certainty.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Oh, this is right.
But in the way you could have a feeling on certain, you could actually have a physical feeling in the body of certainty about one of the Buddhist teachings.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you reckon all the best stuff comes from the dukkha side of things, really? Like the... How, like, I teach that is. So, like, I came to meditation wanting all bliss and rainbows and unicorns and all the good stuff, right?
Okay.
But then, like, later on down the track, I start to see little cracks and I think, actually, I learn more through the chaos than the order, you know? Like.
But, okay, so you say that, but you're wearing a Slayer t-shirt. So I don't know if your stated desire to find unicorns and rainbows is somewhat supported by the...
Very questionable.
Sorry. Just one second. I haven't finished really anything, sorry. but you're right. You know, and we often come for just a palliative. You know, we come for something to make us feel good.
Yeah.
You know, that's okay. You know, we something to help us cope, and coping is okay. It's better than not, right? So you know, I never dismiss that or look down on someone who that's what they want. If somebody just wants to do a little bit of meditation so they can feel a bit better, great. You know, it's a very healthy way to approach that. You know, but of course there's more to the spiritual path, and sooner or later they'll find that. And like you say, suffering is very often the spur that causes someone to want to look deeper.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know,
when you were ending your talk about 100% you put into what you do, I understand that. What about like when it comes to work, you say you put 100% into something, but how do you value the internal outcome and the external? Like, you know, it's a balance where you know you've done your job well and it's all defined with a lot of variables.
Yeah.
But I mean, either one's fine to me, but any perspective would help.
I get what you're saying. Like, because it's not just about the outcomes of your work, but it's also about, you know, the community, people you're working with, and the values that you're expressing through that work and so on. So yeah, you need to try to find that balance as best you can.
So it comes natural, kind of like if you get like you're doing something for yourself, but you're also doing something for the community.
I think
the same, not, you know, intertwined. You take breaks and it's kind of like probably it's how you walk along.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the key is, like, people talk about work-life balance or doing all these kinds of things. But the problem is it's not just about managing your time and about taking breaks and those kinds of things, right? But it's about what direction is your life going, right? And your work is an expression of that. And so what direction is your work doing? And always the thing that really strikes me when I look at the kind of jobs that people do is that in traditional human cultures, most work was good work. Yeah, most work was growing food, and you grow food and feed your family, and it's beautiful. It's a really beautiful thing, yeah, to see the results of what you've done, and to even if you just grow a few veggies in your garden or something like that, or if it's just a pot plant with some herbs in it or something like that, and you can pick it and you can feed it to your family or your friends, and that feeling is such a beautiful feeling, and you know that sense of connection. Or else people would do jobs like they would do building or carpentry or so many different kinds of things that people would do. And most of them, you can really see the results of it. And these days we're so disconnected. Yeah. And we do work where, what's the relation between what we're doing and something like that? When we just finished the job making a website sort of central, and of course the tech world is very much like that, where you're completely, you know, you're just sitting in front of a screen and doing something, and it's got no relation to the actual purpose of the thing that you're doing. And so we tried to bring that kind of spirit into the work we did. We hired a tech firm in Poland. We had a team, about four or five people working with us, and we would talk with them every day over Hangouts and got to know people quite well. But of course, they don't have that really kind of feeling of connection with what we're doing. So this one, when we finished the project, near the finish of the project, I was in Singapore and giving a talk, and the Buddhist Fellowship, there's a big group there, maybe about 100, 150 people. And the problem was that the talk finished at the same time as the meeting. So I was supposed to be meeting our IT team in Poland, right? And so I'm thinking, how do I manage this? And then I thought, oh, no, I'll do it at the same time. So we set up my computer so that when we finished the talk, we began the meeting without telling them, right, the people in Poland, and we started the meeting and talking about the coding and things, and then I said, oh, hang on a minute, I just want you to meet a couple of friends of mine. And then I turned the computer around so that they can see that they'd just been having their meeting in front of a live audience of 100 people. And everyone, and the Singapore Buddhist group is so warm and so enthusiastic, and they all just did this big sadhu, 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 and they got some champagne, they popped, not alcoholic, of course, popping champagne and cheering. People, wow, for minutes, it's incredible. And these programmers have never seen anything like it. And they're just so completely blown away to see that expression of warmth, because they're like, because I knew that the work that we're doing meant so much to so many people, you know? And they knew that intellectually. They knew that it was a good project and valuable and they appreciated it, but they hadn't really seen that effect that it had on people. So that was a really kind of powerful thing to do, that I tried to sort of bring that sense of meaning into their lives at least a little bit. We should wrap up soon, but I think, Ayesha, you had a question beforehand, so
I'm not good at answering short questions.
You had a long and involved question for us.
I just had two things that I'm thinking about. If, like, the idea of karma and the idea of injustice seem to be contradictory, like a lot of Buddhists use karma as an excuse to do nothing for the world because they say it's people's karma. And the other thing that I'm just thinking about is the fourfold sangha necessary, and is it necessary to keep the core Buddhist values alive because this secular mindfulness is becoming a very huge thing, like that's really becoming what a lot of people think Buddhism is. Do you have anything to say about either of those things?
Well, thanks for that little brief little karma and justice. Well, the thing with karma is that karma is essentially about individual ethics and about individual choices, whereas justice is more about social applications of ethics, right, and how things work in society and larger groups. So they're not necessarily they're not completely overlapping. I mean, there's probably some overlap, but they're not completely overlapping. And so the Buddha's concern, of course, was primarily with spiritual progress, and that's why he made the karma the focus of his ethical development, because that's central for individual spiritual progress. But that not to say that justice in terms of looking after society is not important. It's just a slightly different field. So yes, you're quite right that in Buddhism injustice and inequality and so on is often dismissed on the basis of karma. This is wrong and it's very, very harmful. And we need to try to counter it whenever we can. Yeah? So it's not the case that when people experience poverty and inequality and so on, that's necessarily a result of their past karma. And again, just to sort of clarify exactly how this works, without going into too much detail, but what karma does is karma makes it possible to experience things. Right? So the primary role of karma is to drive rebirth. Right? So you get reborn in this world, and when you get reborn in this world, you can experience all of these kinds of things. Now, being reborn in the human realm is always a result of good karma. Right? And I believe that that's fundamental to all the Buddhist traditions. So would that be correct in the Tibetan tradition as well? Pretty sure? The human realm is considered to be a good, realm of rebirth. So yes, you can have bad karma from the past which might affect you in the human realm, but the fact that you're in the human realm is always a result of good karma, because you can make choices and you can practice. So injustice is kind of orthogonal, if you like, or you know, it's at a bit of a kind of an angle to what we're doing, to what we do as spiritual practice, as in terms of individual spiritual practice. But it is something which, right from the beginning, has been always supported and encouraged. You know, like from the beginning, you had an Anatta Pindika, the theatre of the poor, and so on. And this is regarded as being something which is, you know, really important to treat people with decency and so on. And kindness. So justice was the second question? Was it, secular Buddhism going to replace the fourfold sangha? No, of course not. Come on, we've been around for 2,500 years. This is just, secular Buddhism is a ripple in the ocean. We're the sangha.
And look how many of us there are.
No, it's not about quantity. Thinking Buddhism is fine, you know, but it's just a way of understanding and applying Buddhism that you know, works in a certain kind of context. But that doesn't mean it's everything. It's just, you know, Buddhism has always been diverse, and the way that Buddhism is expressed in culture is always diverse, always has been. And you know, the difference really, I really think that people miss or mistake about this is that what's happened actually in Western Buddhism is not so much. It's not so much that that people think, oh, real Buddhism or traditional Buddhism is displaced by secular Buddhism. Whereas what I see is that in traditional Buddhist countries, what I might think of as real Buddhism, i.e. the teaching of the Buddha, is mixed with so much animism, superstition, and all of these kinds of black magic and all of that kind of thing. Yeah? That kind of thing is completely gone in Western Buddhism and secular Buddhism. And mostly that's a good thing. I think. Yeah. Right? And so instead, we have our own Western baggage, which are particular things that we have. It's not that we don't have any, it's not that we don't have cultural baggage, we have a different set of cultural baggage, right? That's all. So it's not that one is more authentic or more real than the other, but there is real Dhamma to be found both in expressions of Buddhism in traditional country and expressions of Buddhism in the West and in secular Buddhism, you know? know, there are genuine expressions of Dhamma. There's also a lot of cultural baggage. It's just a different kind of cultural baggage. So, but yeah, we're the Sangha, so I just have to deal with it. Okay, so we should, sorry, yes.
I was wondering what kind of cultural baggage you say that a West has.
Nice. Again, we are wrapping up, and we've got our wonderful volunteers here who need to finish up, but so we shouldn't keep people for too long. What kind of cultural baggage do Western people bring to Buddhism? I don't know.
Capitalism.
Thank you very much.
Money.
Yeah, how to make money out of it, yeah? That's a good one.
Too much analysis.
Maybe it could go on for quite some time. But I have to be honest, you know, you're probably not asking the right person because I actually don't know much about it. You know, I've never learned much about secular Buddhism or anything like that, you know, so I only hear bits and pieces around the place and things, so I've got a general idea, but I've never really looked at it in any detail.
Well, how would your practice be different from a timer?
From a timer? Which timer?
Look at the different cultural backgrounds. You come from a Western background. As I said, how would your practice, does your practice vary to another monk?
Timer's a little different. I mean, even just to think of it in that kind of context is, to me, you know, it's just not like that. You know, Thailand is so diverse that there are people practicing all different kinds of ways. Yeah. I'll tell you, you may have heard me telling this story before, but I'll just tell you a brief story of a Thai monk that I met in Townsville, who was staying there for a while, and he was from the Ajahn tradition, forest tradition in Thailand, and he taught a meditation group in the evening, Sunday evening, and people would come for the meditation group. And so normally when we have a meditation group, like the way that I do it, and the way in my tradition that we usually, it's pretty straightforward, right? Maybe we have a Buddha image, we might bow at the end, maybe do a short bit of chanting or something, but it's pretty simple. We don't do much in the way of rituals and things like that. Well, this might make me look like positively florid in the rituals that we're doing, right? He would just sit there, and there was no Buddha Rupa, no bowing, nothing like that. The entire thing consisted of saying, start walk meditation. It's literally the words that he said, start walk meditation. And then half an hour later, he said, stop walk meditation, start sit meditation. And then half an hour later, he said, stop sit meditation. And that was it. That was the entire thing. And everyone was really happy. Everyone loved it. A lot of people came and they really enjoyed it and they went home. So he was much more stripped back and hardcore than we are. So it just varies. Yeah. Okay, but we should finish up, and I'm going to finish up by doing the bowing and saying a few words of respect for the Triple Gem, and you're most welcome to join me if you wish.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādeni svāgato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Sūpatipanno bhagavato sāvakasangho sanghaṃ.
My takeaway from today's session is to stay present 100%. The story about laying bricks without